turn it off. One Monday in the fall of 1972, oddly enough on September 11th, CBS anchorman Walter Cronkite decided to end his nightly broadcast with bad news. Professor Hubert Lam says a new ice age is creeping over the Northern Hemisphere, Cronkite began. It could have been a joke or serious. Nothing in his delivery gave any hint. Cronkite's face was an advanced messaging machine, a broadcasting Ferrari. He went on, "It won't be as bad as the last ice age, 60,000 years ago, when New York, Cincinnati, and St. Louis were under 5,000 feet of ice. Presumably no traffic moved, and school was let out for the day." He paused. Again, not a single revealing tick or twitch in that face. "And that's the way it is, Monday, September 11th, 1972. I was just old enough to groan over the hoopla when Walter Cronkite said, "And that's the way it is," for the last time on March 6, 1981. Okay, I get it, I thought. This was a national ritual, and Walter had been with Americans for so many crucial moments in their history, from the death of John F. Kennedy to the moon landing. But who cared about "and that's the way it is"? Was that supposed to be deep? Even as an 11-year-old, the fawning over the iconic sign-off seemed phony, an example of the constant self-congratulation in which TV personalities, anchors particularly, so often indulge. My father, a TV man himself, was amusingly dismissive of what he called the anchor heads. He was a reporter, mind you, not a mere news reader, and he was constantly in trouble with bosses for a sarcastic attitude toward the Ron Burgundies his stations sometimes trotted out as headliners. I worshipped my old man and inherited some of this, so I considered "And That's the Way It Is" to be overrated anchor shtick. With the benefit of age and industry experience, I now see things very differently. In the context of the medium, Cronkite's signature was powerful stuff. Cronkite was telling viewers that they could now safely go back to their lives. It was a promise. Click off and the world will hold together, at least until the next day at the same time. "And That's the Way It Is" was an expression of confidence, a contract between broadcaster and audience. I trust you to come back tomorrow. Enjoy the next 23 hours without worry. This was a message not about the content of the newscast, but about the viewer's relationship to television and the news itself. It was rhetorical punctuation, a period at the end of the sentence. Of course, Cronkite's routine was clever marketing as well. People grew accustomed to the tradition of sitting around the television hearing old Walter tell it like it is. The sign-off was part of the Pavlovian reward. It drew viewers back. But it had another meaning. In that era, there were actually people who read newspapers from beginning to end. As one former newspaper chain owner put it, this was a time when people could say, "I read the news," and mean all of it. The concept of news having an ending still existed. There was a lot that was wrong and deceptive about the era of news Cronkite dominated. News watchers were presented with a highly limited and simplistic vision of the world, presented almost entirely by white dudes. Coverage downplayed or omitted countless injustices, both at home and abroad. Many of those deceptions were chronicled in Manufacturing Consent. But since the 70s and 80s, we've moved into an entirely new realm of messaging. The subtext is dramatically different from what it was in Cronkite's day. Most news consumers haven't noticed the change or are too young to know. But it's an awesome difference, and a terrifying one, if you know what to look for. You can tell a lot about a country by how boring its media is. If you turn on the TV and immediately feel like going to sleep, it generally means the political class feels secure. In the Soviet Union of the 70s, A person with the misfortune to turn on the television might be treated to pulse-pounding content like Rural Hour, or a tourism show like Explorers Club, which showed Soviet citizens the amazing destinations they could legally visit, like Kiev or Kiev. It's no accident that with the arrival of perestroika in the 80s came a new form of TV, which for the first time acted like it had to compete for your attention. Soviet programmers brought in bawdy soap operas to dub from Latin America, and just before the collapse of the USSR, introduced an emotive, brightly lit Wheel of Fortune spin-off that's on the air to this day. The audience, no longer fully captive, had to be grabbed. America, much further along in its development, has sprinted far past that point. We are light years beyond having to hustle to grab audiences, and are deep into a phenomenon that is closer to induced addiction or cult worship than mere marketing. Turn on the TV in today's America, and it's a shock to the senses. You can feel the producers in the background panicking at the thought of your thumb on the remote. Content is designed not just to be lurid and sensational, but immediately disquieting from a psychological standpoint. You're meant to see something in the first flash that upsets you to the point of needing to hang in at least until mental balance is restored. This is the genius of the crawl or chyron in modern cable news, that giant banner sweeping across the screen that tells you what the anchor head plans on saying. Great examples are alt-right founder questions if Jews are people, or Pelosi criticized for five white guys joke. In the former case, you'll stick with Jake Tapper for a few more minutes to make sure he tells off that alt-right upstart, whose message he's deliberately put on national television for millions to hear. In the latter case, if you're watching Fox, you probably are a white guy, so you have to keep the program on to find out why the House Minority Leader is joking about you. There's nothing new about yellow headlines. They've been with us since at least the turn of the 20th century, when Joseph Pulitzer's New York World battled William Randolph Hearst's New York Morning Journal for circulation. Famed headers like Woman Jumps from Brooklyn Bridge, Survives Mad Leap, or Headless Body in Topless Bar operated on the same premise that causes highway rubbernecking, that is, the inability to turn one's head from something gross or horrible. My father claims to have seen a headline in his youth that read, Headless, Handless Body Believed Homicide, but we've never been able to track it down. There was desperation behind those headlines, but it was just commercial, one newspaper not wanting to lose to another. We still have that same dynamic on cable and in the blogosphere, vastly accelerated, if anything. The competition for eyeballs is more furious than ever. But there's an even deeper added dimension. We don't just want your eyes on us at all times. We want your attention away from something else. Tone is the first thing you should think about when you turn on a TV news show or click on a news story. The emotional desperation in the attitude of modern news content is striking. There is no Walter Cronkite smiling and telling you it's safe to turn the news off now. On the contrary, the between-the-lines message of most news isn't just worry, 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 but stay, stay, stay. Anchors often cast scolding, imploring glares at the screen, all but telling viewers they'll be betraying humanity if they switch off. Cable stations don't promise ends to the news. There is no mental finish line. They pass off one show to another, and these segues have become formalized, even popular. The standard is probably Rachel Maddow's handoff to Lawrence O'Donnell, where the two MSNBC anchors gently banter to blur a five-minute line between shows. On the surface, it's all jovial and jokey, but it's a million miles from the good night and until tomorrow fuck the ice age message of Cronkite. A Maddow-O'Donnell handoff is always drearily about anti-Republican solidarity just as a Tucker Carlson Sean Hannity baton pass, while less formalized, never leaves the anti-Democrat theme for a second. We are always at war with each other. It never stops, not for one second. This is a profound expression of political instability at the top of our society. There is a terror of letting audiences think for themselves that we've never seen before. There's no go back home tonight, rest, and think it over. Even from show to show, the viewer is asked to remain glued to the conflict at all times. In print media, your eyes scroll down to similarly themed stories, stringing you from one outrage to another. Keep clicking, keep delving deeper into the argument. Make it more and more your identity. We don't want you signing off until tomorrow, because we don't want you to even understand that you have an inner dialogue separate from the news experience. Click on, watch, read, tweet, argue, come back, click again, repeat. Do it over and over, rubbing the nerve ends away just a little bit each time. With each engagement, you're signing over more and more of your intellectual autonomy. You'll soon become dependent on the cycle, to the point where you'll lose the ability to dispute what you're being told, because disputing would mean diluting the bond with your favored news sources. Once you reach this point, you've entered the realm of belief, as opposed to conclusion. This, without a doubt, is a form of religious worship. It's what was being parodied in the movie Network, in which an anchorman who loses his mind and begins telling the truth on air is swallowed up and turned into the biggest hit show in the country. That film was a parable about how TV can commoditize and ritualize anything, from profane truth to madness. Mass media makes the act of watching more important than the words. It can take rage and defiance, and in a snap, turn it into obedience and submission. Listening in anger to your favorite political program, you will act like a person who is shaking a fist at power, when in fact you've been neutralized as an independent threat, reduced to a prop in a show. Like all religions, the arc of devotion can be bent with time. When belief flags, the tenets of the faith will become more and more extreme, the manipulations more aggressive, the promises more explicit. A religion becomes a cult when it doesn't allow the testing of its premises. Cronkite's See You Tomorrow model, encouraging you to return to mental autonomy, disappears. Mentally, they don't want you ever leaving the compound now. No interacting with suppressive persons. Social media has wildly enhanced the illusion that there's no life outside news. Once upon a time, you didn't know who reporters were once they put the microphone down. You rarely knew what they stood for, whether they were jokesters or bullies, conservative demagogues or mellow hippies. Now reporters never go home. They are on social media day and night. They share everything from pictures of their cats to takes on the North Korean nuclear crisis. Unfortunately, because pushing any of the various taboos, I don't care, or I don't know, or I hate both parties, can have career-altering consequences, they don't show truly different sides to themselves. Most of these social media accounts simply become personalized extensions of their politicized public personalities. So Jake Tapper can spend half his day retweeting about how kids should play with dogs more, and the other half sending messages about how Trump should end the shutdown. Following, you never go home to non-political space. You're always on the compound. News consumers on both sides today behave like cultists, self-isolating intellectually, kept that way with a steady diet of terrifying stories about fellow citizens. Red staters are told liberals are terror sympathizers, desperate out of white guilt to eviscerate American culture from within. Blue staters are peppered daily with stories of fellow travelers and traitors in their midst, an incredible example being NBC's effort to paint presidential candidate Tulsi Gabbard as a tool of the Kremlin on the day she announced her run. Most intelligent people in the Gabbard case could see that Beltway hacks were piling on a politician for taking a heretical stance against a foreign military deployment. Still, the underlying message was important. Russian influence is everywhere, and anyone, even a member of Congress, might be a witting or unwitting agent. Be vigilant. Suspect everyone except us. We're the only people you know are unaffected. This deeply paranoid view of the human experience, telling all America it lives on a violent, invisible influence battlefield, is the opposite of what the news used to be. The news was once a placid ritual designed to amp down the viewer's political reflex. The church of the press was a sleepy place then. In the 70s and 80s, in fact, news was infamous for its non-confrontational nature and vapidity. This was the joke of Anchorman, that the biggest story in human history was a panda birth. News companies then were trying to train audiences to be docile and unconcerned. A local news affiliate would pack its lineup with cat-in-tree segments, and the weather slots got longer and longer throughout the decades. A local reporter once joked to me that the highest-paid news gatherer in every city would soon be a helicopter. Aerial shots of the local skyline were more important than 50, 100 exposés. Within a decade or so after Watergate, audiences had been trained not to want to watch disturbing news. They were soon more interested in the weather. Today, it's the opposite. We are trying to keep your brain locked in conflict, not just for the grubby commercial reason that it keeps people tuned in, but because it prevents them from thinking about other things. But what? Herman and Chomsky, in Manufacturing Consent, identified 5 filters through which they said mass media operates. They were ownership, advertising, sourcing, flack, and an organizing religion. Their basic idea: news media is a synthesis of elite concerns. It has to serve the ends of media owners by making a profit or enhancing the prestige of a larger profit-making network. It also has to coincide with values of advertisers, strengthen the relationships between top news agencies and high-level government sources, and serve the propaganda aims of those sources, often by organizing the population against a common enemy. The news at its core is still a vehicle for advancing elite interests. Most of the filters still hold, but the model has been disrupted in one key way. As Chomsky notes, the idea of anti-communism as an organizing religion has gone bust. We've tried out other common enemies. Islamic terrorists were serviceable for a while. Occasionally a dictator like Slobodan Milosevic will get some airtime in this role. Russia is back for a second run lately, minus the socialist black hat. None of these antagonists are close enough to home for modern audiences. This is why the biggest change to Chomsky's model is the discovery of a far superior common enemy in modern media: each other. So long as we remain a bitterly divided two-party state, we'll never want for TV villains. Who we hate just depends on what channel we watch. The Soviet Union let us all down by collapsing under the weight of its sociopathic leadership and systemic corruption, removing both itself and global communism as a functional adversary. The divided nature of our media acts in part to prevent us from seeing similar cracks widen in our own empire. Once, Cats in Trees, Dynasty, and cool vids on MTV were enough to distract people from broad institutional problems. Today, people are struggling and have lost so much trust in institutions that the only way to keep eyes away from the rot is by throwing the hardest propaganda fastballs. We can't allow attention to flag for even a moment because the evidence of political incompetence and corruption is so rampant and undeniable. For most non-white and white citizens, healthcare services are a catastrophe. There are entire congressional districts without a functioning maternity ward. Stories of couples having to drive 100 miles at high speed to have their babies delivered are no longer uncommon. We suffer from profound and worsening inequality in income and criminal justice outcomes, a complete lack of job security for most, crumbling infrastructure aggravated by extraordinary inefficiency and waste in government, an epidemic of anti-competitive practice and rent-seeking among the biggest companies, and devastating environmental threats on multiple fronts, from overfished oceans to a toxic garbage patch twice the size of Texas floating in the Pacific. These and 100 other problems are common to the entire global population, not just Republicans or Democrats in the United States. Fixing these problems would be hard for our leaders. It's much easier to stall by keeping people obsessed with intramural/provincial arguments. As a bonus, this has been an extraordinarily profitable media strategy. In 2018, most all the big media companies, despite or because of marked declines in journalistic performance, made buck. The New York Times made a second quarter profit of $24 million, which, as any newspaper person will tell you, is good for, well, a newspaper. CBS made a third quarter profit of $1.24 billion, even after President Les Moonves, the guy who made trouble by admitting Trump was bad for America but good for the bottom line, was forced to resign in a hashtag MeToo scandal. At the end of 2018, MSNBC sat in the ratings poll position ahead of Fox for the first time in 18 years, even as Fox Cable itself had record revenues of $1.51 billion. This is the only strategy left that makes money and serves the right political purposes. In order to satisfy everyone up top with a say in the matter, from advertisers to internet distributors to politicians who drive news to political donors, this has to be the outcome. Anything but the most intense kind of reality show civil war would leave Americans free to stare their real problems in the face. This ruse is inverse Chomsky. If we once manufactured the consent of the population for everything from the Vietnam War to the bombing of Kosovo to the occupation of Iraq, we're now manufacturing discontent. It's the only way to prevent a popular uprising. It can't hold. As we saw with the election of Trump and with the Bernie Sanders campaign, and with countless protest movements around the world, from Catalonia to the Gilets Jaunes, voters are not completely stupid. They know enough to be angry. Commercial news media has tried frantically to come up with enough red capes to keep us charging forward, but they're running out of gimmicks. It will be hard to keep concealed for long the obvious fact that turning off the news results in an instantly positive psychological change for most people. If you want to be happier, if you want to live in a world that may be thick with problems but is at least a sunnier place where people are more decent to one another and more willing to cooperate and show kindness, just turn off the tube. If you must be a news consumer, be aware of all the pressures laid out in this book. Remember the complex economics at work every time you click on a story or turn on the TV. From the moment your eyes move to the screen, one company is selling you a consumer product, which you're paying for by being subject to advertising or through a subscription. Meanwhile, another company is selling you to another set of buyers. Your attention is one product, the data about your surfing behavior is another, and so on. The news, the actual information in the middle, is almost incidental to these transactions. What matters is the amount of time you spend engaged. This is why you should always be suspicious of emergencies, indeed of anyone who tells you to worry about things you can't control. Think about how Walter Cronkite told you to blow off an ice age and smiled as he signed off until tomorrow. Then think about how Rachel Maddow, just after the 2019 New Year, hypothesized in the middle of a nationwide cold front that the Russians could turn off your heat at any moment. This McCarthyite scare campaign was instantly ratified by the American government's fact-checking arm, Polygraph, a division of Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. This was a classic example of how political and commercial incentives can align seamlessly. No parent who goes to bed at night looking at their children nestled under covers can afford not to think about the possibility of the heat being switched off. And not just in your house, but throughout the whole region. What would you do if there were no warm places to bring your children, your elderly parents? This is news that demands the retention of space in your head post-broadcast. It's the opposite of Cronkite's chummy "see you tomorrow." It's fear, loathing, and disquieting outrage they insist you are patriotically required to retain. These are tactics that betray desperation, an empty hand. We've seen it before. When George W. Bush wanted to invade Iraq, his White House had to go so far down the road of upsetting the American public that it's comic to remember. Even much-trusted Colin Powell was forced to agree with Bush that Saddam Hussein had drones that, if transported, could be used to spray poison or biological agents on the American heartland. How exactly was Saddam going to do this transporting? On his aircraft carriers? We reported this as serious news. But they weren't really worried about Iraqi drones. They were worried people wouldn't be scared enough to support the war. That was just a temporary mania, drummed up for the very narrow purposes of getting the population A, backing a pointless invasion, and B, helping the Republicans win a couple of elections, beginning with the 2002 midterms. This current craze is far more intense, bipartisan, and open-ended. It's not designed to be a temporarily blinding fervor. This is panic you're told not to excise from your life ever, or else. Or else what? We don't articulate that for a very good reason. Of all the taboos and deceptions in media, this is the one we lie about most. The thing we're most afraid to discuss has to do with precisely that question of what happens if you should stop following the news. The answer, of course, is nothing. Not only can you live without us, you probably should, most of the time anyway. And that's the way it is. 14. The Scarlet Letter.